He got to within about 50 feet, I suppose, and he called out in perfect English, "Are you all right?"
Oh, really?
Well, you know, and then he got closer, and this man, he was a tall, and we're Burmese people, it's quite small. Yeah. He was tall, well-formed, good-looking, pretty healthy-looking guy of around 30 years, I think, something like that. Yeah. And I said, "Yes, I'm all right. Who are you?" So he told me his name. And I said, "Well, are you the head man of the village?" He said, "I suppose so." And I said, "Where did you learn to speak English?" "Oh," he said, "I spent 2 years in one of the universities in Britain, mm-hmm. learning, studying for an agriculture degree. He'd been sent over by the Burmese government, and then he returned to Burma, and his job was to teach the Burmese how to grow productively in whatever part of the country they might be in. And that's what he was doing when the war broke out.
Yeah.
And he was marooned there. He couldn't get out, couldn't move on. I would love to have had the time to sit and talk to him, but I said, "I don't have much time to talk. I think I'd better get out of here." "Oh, no," he said, "you're okay." I said, "Where are the Japanese?" He said, "Oh, they're that way." "How far?" "Oh, 4 or 5 miles probably." I said, "That's too close, because those will be the guys that I was just visiting.
Mm-hmm.
And if they catch me, they won't be very happy."
Yeah.
"So which way is the British Army nearby?" He said, "If you take that trail and just follow it, keep going north." So that's what I did. And the next day, I heard the most wonderful words that you could ever hope to hear. "Halt! Who goes there?" And it was a Gurkha group, small group. And if you're, I've said this before, if you're in trouble in Burma and you're looking for a friend, you can't find a better one than a Gurkha. They were absolutely loyal to the British forces, and they were tough. They were tough guys. They were really tough guys. So they took me back to their camp, and then I guess their commanding officer got one of the sergeants to take me in a jeep, take me back towards the squadron. And coming towards us was another jeep coming towards us, and it was my squadron CO.
Oh, really?
Coming to look for me. So that was the end of that story.
Now, when you were flying, what did you, or how did you feel about the ground crew?
Ground crew?
Yeah.
They are, without question, the unsung heroes of that war or any other war. Those guys work their butts off. And, you know, it's not a very comfortable climate, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
And we only got they had a major difficulty in getting spare parts to repair the aircraft or anything like that. But they did a fabulous job, an absolutely fabulous job. And I just wish that I had thought to tell them that before I left the squadron, but I'm ashamed to say I didn't.
So you had the utmost confidence in their abilities?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
How did the weather in Burma affect your Spitfire? Like just the sand and the heat, humidity?
Many of our guys said that the worst enemy that we had was not the Japanese, it was the bloody weather. Because in the monsoon season particularly, there were days on end when you couldn't fly. But the army wasn't terribly active either during those periods because they couldn't see. But it was miserable. We lost some one or two aircraft through the monsoons.
Did the sand or the heat affect the machinery at all, the equipment?
I guess it did, but
not noticeable.
I was not conscious of. I guess that's the best answer. I really don't know.
So from your first mission in Burma to your last mission, how had the equipment improved, or like, was it noticeable for you? And did your, when, say from your first dogfight to your last dogfight, did the equipment improve?
Well, because that was just a very short period of time, just a few months at the beginning, and we had the same. Okay, I mentioned the fact that as a particular aircraft got updated, it would get a new number, like a Mark II, Mark III. I did my operational training here on Spitfire Mark I and II. Those were the aircraft that were used in the Battle of Britain. Mm-hmm. In fact, the aircraft we got were actually Battle of Britain veterans, clapped out Spitfires that had the guts taken out of them just about. But when I left England to go out to the Far East, the Spitfire squadrons were flying the Mark V, and there was talk about some of them getting the newest Mark IX. Mm-hmm. Now, when I got out to the squadron, they had just received Spitfire Mark VIII, which, in my view, was a better Mark than the Mark IX. But in any event, the squadrons in Britain were still, a lot of them were still flying Mark V. So we, for the one and only time, we had a superior Mark, the Spitfire, than they did back in Britain.
More of the battle info, that was the decisive battle that,
that was
forced the Japanese finally out.
And that was that was not just an Air Force battle. That was a very, very tough army battle. I mean, those guys, they just went through hell. Absolutely.
So what was it like in the air during that battle, since you had total air control at that point?
After the battle, after that battle was over, we had total control.
So what was it like during that battle to get that control? Like, because a lot of the forces were, the Japanese forces were sent back, recalled?
No, we were, as I mentioned, we were given an army support role. Mm. And we still did some escort work. In fact, from MFAL, for a period of time, we would escort the Dakotas, the DC-3s, who were dropping food supplies to the army up the further up the Irrawaddy River, and we would escort them in and out again. Mm-hmm. Here again, the escort duty. Normally, you'd sit way up above them, so you could keep an eye on the whole area. But because there were virtually no Japanese fighters around, where these Dakotas were being attacked was they had to come in low, relatively, and straight to the drop zone. Well, I mean, that's a sitting duck to some guy on the ground. So what we did was get down there with them, and any movement at all we just shot at it to make so that they didn't get. It was pretty successful, actually.
So the Battle of Burma, or just Burma in general, the war in Burma has been referred to as the Forgotten War. How does that make you feel? What do you think about that?
Still feel a little bitter.
Yeah.
I just don't understand why we celebrate the end of the war on the anniversary of VE Day, when it went on for another 3 months and many thousands of men were killed. You know, that's not nice.
No, I understand. Yeah. So, do you feel that the whole Burma theater was just as important as the European theater in the history of the war?
No question that it was not as important. It was important, but didn't carry. I mean, there was a sense of urgency in Europe. I mean, the German army was only 22 miles away across the English Channel. and they were armed to the teeth and geared up and ready to go. And I don't argue with the fact that that the Air Force and the Army and the Navy had to be primarily involved in the war in Europe. Otherwise, Britain would have been occupied and this would be a whole different world we live in today. Mm-hmm. So I have no bad feelings about that at all. I understand it. It's the way it should have been. Mm-hmm. What I don't understand and gets me hot under the collar is when the war in Europe was over and the Allies were victorious, it was a matter of, well, that's that. Now we can settle back and get back to living a normal life.
Mm-hmm. While you're still fighting. So you were a flight lieutenant, which is one rank below a squadron leader?
No, the other way around. Your first rank as an officer was a pilot officer. Mm-hmm. Then the next up was a flying officer. Then the next up was a flight lieutenant. And the next up was a squadron leader. And then a wing commander.
When you were promoted to a flight lieutenant, did your men treat you any differently? Or were you still... You're still Ken Paston. Nothing changed really except...
I mean, the only difference was that sometimes, like, the instructions came from me rather than to me. It was not an issue. We were all on a first name basis. Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't that formality there that usually is there.
Formality when you're living on a piece of mat inside, sharing a pup tent with one other guy. Mm-hmm. Not much room for formality there. We were in tents for the whole trip, all the time I was there.
So when you were there, just to, I guess, the best thing you did to relax, what would you do for leisure time in Burma? Because the heat obviously was a huge factor in the rain. Mm-hmm. So what is it that you would do to take your mind off the war, perhaps?
Well, there was absolutely nothing available in the way of entertainment. I mean, it's just nothing. I remember one time somebody came back to camp with a 3-month-old baby. I guess it was a a jaguar. Dots on it, that's a jag, I think.
A cheetah?
Yeah, probably. And so we all took it in turns to tame this thing. It refused to be tamed, so we took it back and jumped. Well, I mean, you know, and you played a lot of cards and you smoked too much and sometimes you'd be lucky and get a movie sent to you.
So
you'd watch that same movie over. I mean, if we were close to a river, as when we were at Sadong, which is just straight west of Mandalay, that's where we were stationed when I got shot down. Mm-hmm. A little bit further to the west of us was a river called the Mu, M-U, and it wasn't terribly far away. And as soon as the Army assured us that that was safe land over there, we used to, if we were off duty, mm-hmm. we would jeep over there or take a truck over there and swim.
Just something to do.
One day we were swimming around in there and we looked up and there was a bunch of British Army guys standing on the bank back there, and we sort of waved to each other. And we hollered out and said, "Are you coming in for a swim?" And I said, "No, we are here to do some fishing." And I think somebody said something about, "Well, you won't get many fish around with us splashing around in the water." They said, "Oh, don't worry. Where's your fishing rods?" We don't have fishing rods. What we've got is, we should pull out a Mills bomb and toss it in the water. And if you've never been standing absolutely naked up to your armpits in a river,
yeah,
and had a Mills bomb go off not very far away, it's quite an experience. you get the sudden feeling that you're going to spend a life of chastity from there on. They got a big laugh out of it, but of course the water deadened the explosion. So it turned up, some fish floated up, belly up. And so, but that was it, really.
At any point, like when you were in Burma, would you talk about the battles going on in Europe at all? Like, was it discussed?
No, we were very devoid of news. Nobody had a radio that I can think of. No, it was not something that was discussed, really.
Now, you were saying earlier that the Americans, they came in and played a large role in Burma as well. Do you feel the RAF and the RCF played just as a big role and it's not as,
oh, yes,
not as mentioned just because it's the Americans?
No, there was nothing like that. The vast majority of the American Air Force was, as I mentioned, further down on the islands. They were over in the Philippines, or they were down in the, can't think of the names of them. There were a few squadrons. They had what we call Liberators. I've forgotten what the Americans always had a name like a B-15 or something.
Yeah.
We call them Liberators, and they were torpedo bombers, and they were stationed on the Akyab coast of Burma, and that was what they would do. And they'd go out after enemy shipping, or sad to say, unfortunately, quite a bit of Burmese shipping. They were taking food supplies down or whatever to the Japanese, which we thought was not very nice. So these guys in the Libs, the Liberators, would go down. And every once in a while, not very often, but my squadron very, very occasionally escorted them. But there were other squadrons in the Akia, Spitfire and Hurricane squadrons, and they used to escort them. Oh no, we got along. We didn't see them very often, but whenever we did, we got along fine. Oh no, they were a great bunch of guys, and they had their necks stuck out just as far as we did. They did a damn good job, and so did we.
Now, the European theater ended 3 months before the Burmese did. What was your reaction to the end of war in Europe and then the end of war in Burma?
My reaction to...
Like, when the war ended in Europe, did you hear about that?
Yes, we were aware that VE Day, Victory Europe Day, as it was called, in June, I guess. We didn't really have any great feelings about it one way or the other, except to say, well, I guess maybe now we'll get some fresh bodies sent out here, and who knows, maybe we'll get back home yet. But it didn't work out that way.
And so when the war finally ended, after the bombs dropped, how did you react to that when you were finally done?
Yeah, well, I left the squadron.
At least when the fighting was done, like when the ceasefire came.
Actually, at that point, I was way up just outside of Peshawar, what is now Pakistan.
Okay.
It's still India in those days.
Yeah.
And we were only a matter... I was a test pilot up there. There were several Indian Air Force flying training schools up in that area. Mm-hmm. And they tended to break a few aircraft every once in a while, and they'd haul them into where I was, and either rebuild them or patch them up or scrap them and keep the pieces for the spares or whatever. And my job was to see if they flew.
See, tested them.
Take them through a specific routine of testing. That's where I was when. I'm not sure whether I was there or whether I had moved to Karachi at that point, doing the same thing, mm-hmm. except in Karachi, we were receiving brand new aircraft, oftentimes still crated up.
Oh, really?
And the ground crew would bolt them together, and we'd. I was alone in just outside of Peshawar. I was the only pilot there. But in Karachi, because it was such a busy place, there were four or five of us there. I was in I left Karachi in April of 1946 to go home.
So there was that period of six, seven months where you were. Where there was.
I left the squadron in 45, as I recall.
So there's about a half year period where you were just testing those.
Yeah, there was a. Here we go. I left the squadron on May the 5th of 1945. So I was 12 months as a test pilot in, the name of the place was Rizalpur, just outside of Peshawar. Mm-hmm. And then after that, Karachi, Jigarh, Karachi. So yeah.
Knowing what you know now, like from the past 60 years of the war and all the follow-up documentaries and research that's been done, if you went back, would you do it exactly the same way you did before? You would still join the Air Force? And
well, that's sort of like asking any man or woman of my age, if you could go back through your life, what changes would you make? Yes, I'd make changes, of course. But they'd be changes that would not occur to me as a lad of 20, 21, 22. I mean, life was a gas in those days.
So you would still...
But as you get older, you mature, and you look at things in a much more mature way. Mm-hmm. Some of the things that I, if I had the opportunity, I would do again, like going back and shaking the hands of every ground crew guy, mm-hmm. because I repeat, they were unsung heroes, those guys. And some of the things that happened later, I would have done them differently. But nothing outstanding.
Obviously, the war was a large part of your life. Is it something that you think about like every day, or is it something that you try not to think about, or is it whenever something, you know, triggers something in your mind, then you think about it? Because you have all these pictures of Spitfires and things on your wall here.
Well, it's an odd thing that you would ask that question. Just the other day I was talking to a group of my buddies, and we all agreed in the same area, surprisingly. We got out of the Air Force, and, you know, all of a sudden, there I was standing on the street in city clothes. And what do I do now? I went back to work in pharmacy. And in a relatively short space of time, my concentration was pharmacy and getting on in that profession and getting a few other things, like I got my master's in business administration and things like that. I was working in the pharmaceutical industry for a company that was in the development, research and development oriented. And it was very interesting work, but it was very, very demanding work. It really demanded a lot of time. And so help me, it would be very, very seldom I thought back to the war, except maybe on the 11th of November, the Battle of Britain Day on the 15th of September, you know, a couple of times like that, I'd say, oh yeah. But even then it was, but, so then I retired and moved over here, found the Aircrew Association, and now all I think about
is
my time in the Air Force. I don't think about the 30 odd years I spent or more from 1946 when I got out, I'd be 24 years old. And I retired at 65, so there's 41 years in the pharmaceutical business. And what do I, if I look back on my life, where do I look back? You'd expect me to look back over those 41 years, but I don't. And in fact, one guy wrote to me the other day and he said, you know, I've reached the stage where I think I'm going to deliberately erase the Air Force from my memory. He said, so many of my buddies are dying, very bad health and one thing else, and it's very depressing. Funny, just 2 days ago,
on just the latest question here, there's you see all these movies on TV, like this Band of Brothers, Saving Private Ryan, and you're already shaking your head. Obviously, they're not.
What an imagination those writers
okay,
have.
That's the question right there. So if there was a movie being made, like trying to be realistic, what would you
If
like?
I could use a time-worn old Air Force saying, what a bunch of bullshit. Oh, dear God.
So obviously it's that bad, like where it's all it's just entertainment. Even when they try to be as close to the realism as possible.
Yeah. I mean, I can understand they're not going to send planes up and shoot at each other, but it could be a little more realistic. I mean, you don't see too many of them anymore, but there was a time during the 50s, 60s, and even in, you know, particularly. And the portrayal of a pilot was a man in his Air Force blue and his hat on at a cocky angle and a scarf wound around his neck and his tunic wide open up here. I'm strutting along, you know, come on.
So what would you like to, like, what would you like to see? Would you like to see more, like, of the camaraderie that was built, or more of, like,
I'd just like it to be more factual, more realistic.
Like, based off all the research that's been done.
Did you see the movie that Tom Hanks was in?
Saving Private Ryan? Saving Private Ryan?
Yes. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Now, there was a realistic movie. I mean, that was superb, the way that thing was filmed. And I can't think of anybody in the Army who would have any objection to any part of that. That was very real.
So you'd like to see something like that, but more in an Air Force?
Yeah. I mean, if they want to do a picture about the Air Force, okay.
Nothing cheesy like the Battle of Britain, the movie.
That's, I mean, that was... It shouldn't be that difficult with the things that are done nowadays in modern, with modern photography, I'm talking about films now, to put a bunch of guys in a makeup bomber and have them, somebody tell them how things went and drill them through what it goes through, have it get hit, have it catch fire, have the guys jump out, it's all be done in the studio and look very realistic.
Yeah.
With this, this scarf.
Do like is obviously to get away from that bravado.
Oh,
now that American.
Yeah. Good.
So that's everything.
Well, thank you very much for coming and for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for your time. Appreciate that.
I